Andy Doyle here, welcoming all of you to another season of Indians Baseball.
Here's a list of players we'll be inviting to camp.
This guy here is dead.
Cross him off, then.
We'd love for you to come to spring training for a shot at this year's club.
By the way, you were with me last night. Who's this chick on top of me?
We'd still like to take a look at you at our spring camp.
Not sure I can make it by then.
Who is that?
Serrano.
What's his religion?
Voodoo.
Say hey! Willie Mays Hayes here. Play like Mays, and I run like Hayes. How you doing?
What the hell league you been playing in?
California Penal.
Don't you have any proven major league talent?
Now I want to put together a team that'll help us relocate to Miami.
You want us to lose?
We've been losing. What I want is for us to finish dead last.
This year, the Cleveland Indians have a multi-talented team.
The first offering, just a bit outside.
Every time we win, we peel a section.
Tom Berenger.
Zipper on your skirt stuck.
Use your imagination.
Charlie Sheen.
These things make me look ridiculous.
Seeing's the most important thing, son. I don't think it's that important.
Corbin Burnson. And Bob Uecker.
Haywood swings and crushes one towards South America.
Major League.
That ball wouldn't have been out of a lot of parks.
Name one.
Yellowstone.
Baseball season has arrived, guys, so it's time for us to hit a home run with today's episode of Reconsideration. I'm your host, John Diner.
I'm David Munchak.
And I'm Brent Hutchins.
And this is the podcast that takes a look back at some of our favorite films from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and we're checking out how they hold up here today. And we've got a fun one. It's been on the list forever, and it's finally time. We debated, do we do it at the beginning of baseball season? Do we do it during the World Series? But we're doing it now. It's Major League.
Oh, yeah, buddy. Ooh. Classic.
A classic late 80s sports experience.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, it is. I'm excited to talk about this one. I have a lot of fond memories with this movie.
Yeah, yeah, I do too. And that's, I think that's why I've been wanting to do it for so long. There is, very so often we talk about these movies that have been on our list forever, and it's just, you know, where do we sort of slide it in? And this is definitely one of those.
Yeah. If the listeners haven't figured it out yet, the list, by the way, is every movie ever made between the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and sometimes the 60s and earlier, because John can't keep his decades straight, but that's all right.
Yeah. You know what's not going to be on that list? I'm just going to say, because I just saw it for the first time, unrelated to Major League, but Elizabethtown, not on the list.
Not on the list.
Never going to talk about it.
But it's Cameron Crowe, right?
Oh, but it is not good.
It's late Cameron Crowe. What was the other one he did that was also like Aloha or?
Aloha, yeah.
Is that what it was
panned.
Called?
Panned by critics.
Yeah.
That's the new one.
Well, new.
It's newer.
If it was 15, what was it, 15 years ago?
Oh.
10 years ago? Feels
yeah,
like.
It's like 10, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but has he done anything since? I don't even know.
He's done some stuff, but nothing of note really since.
I don't remember hating Elizabethtown though. I even watched it probably in the last 5 years.
Try it again. It's I sort of despised it, but
that's with the you know, the Archer elf from,
yeah,
from and I think Lord of the Rings, and
That's part of it is, you know, if he doesn't have a sword or a bow and arrow, I'm not sure it's working. But anyway, we're not here to talk about that. We are looking at Major League from the great cinematic year of 1989.
It's a good year.
Yeah, it's a great year. I mean, there's rumors. Actually, it's not even a rumor. It's true. We did a whole episode looking back at the summer of 89. You can check that out in the archives at reconsideration.com. Before we get into it, let's do our 6 degrees of reconcinimation. And it's my turn. For those unfamiliar, I'm going to shout out a movie, and Brent and David are going to have to connect that movie to Major League in as few moves as possible. And I feel like I'm going to make it easy, but you guys tell me. Tom Berenger, co-star of Major League, once starred in a movie called Butch and Sundance: The Early Years with William Catt. Let's go back to the original film, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and connect that film to Major League. So we will come back at the end of the episode, and the guys will have come up with a great move, probably in one, maybe two moves, right, to connect.
Should I don't know. Pretty easy.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I'll get back to you at the end of the show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So, Brent, catch everybody up. What is happening in Major League?
Sure. Major League, directed and written by David S. Ward, is a sports comedy that was made in 1989 that injects a fresh dose of irreverence into the world of baseball. Set against the backdrop of the struggling Cleveland Indians, the film introduces a cast of unlikely heroes. Aging catcher Jake Taylor, wild pitcher Ricky Wild Thing Vaughn, and spiritually inclined power hitter Pedro Serrano form a team that, by all conventional standards, shouldn't stand a chance. The movie throws us a curveball when Rachel Phelps, the team's new owner, reveals a secret agenda. She aims to assemble a roster so dismal that it would drive down attendance, allowing her to relocate the franchise. However, much to her chagrin, the eclectic group of misfit players begins to defy the odds, turning the team's fortunes around and sparking an unexpected winning streak. What unfolds is a tale of camaraderie, resilience, and the enduring spirit of the underdog. Major League.
What an amazing original piece of describing this. Well done.
Okay, David, take us back in time. Let's go back to April 7th, 1989. What's happening in the world?
I'm going to talk more about what's happening in America, because that's the country we are in. It's where we grew up. And that is the sport that is the all-American sport. The Nintendo Entertainment System continued its expansion in April. We were talking April 7th, 1989, retailing for about $179, which is about $500 in today's money, paying about $40 for the average price. Funny enough, the Nintendo Switch is about 75% less than that, I believe, if you were to comparatively the system that is now sold by Nintendo today. And as of this movie's release, the Game Boy was going to release 2 weeks later, forever changing America's relationship with Tetris. In music, Eternal Flame by the Bengals would be ousted by The Look from Roxette on the Billboard 100 number one for the weekend. And it would be some months before you would see Right Here Waiting from Richard Marx, Miss You Much by Janet Jackson, and We Didn't Start the Fire by Billy Joel to hit number one for multiple weeks. With the Major League Baseball season would kick off 2 days after this movie's release on April 9th. The real-life Cleveland Indians would go 73-89 for the year with a payroll of about $9.9 million. And the Yankees would only go 74-89 with a payroll of $17 million. The Yanks would have a better home attendance record, about 2.1 million tickets, while the Indians would sell about 1.3. So the big rivalry of the film does not reflect the reality of that upcoming season, or I think even the prior seasons. I don't think the Yankees were quite the powerhouse for at least a few more years, right?
This is still like we're in the world of the Mets in the late 80s here.
Right.
I remember this season, 1990, 1991, were terrible years for the Yankees, almost kind of like how they are now.
Yeah,
but I remember going to Yankee games and just looking around, and it felt like there was nobody there. It was really sad. And then they would turn by like the 93 season, they started the wheels were in motion to get on track. So,
gotcha. So that's pretty much all I had in the summary of April 7th, 1989.
What a time to be alive.
It really was. Great times. Good times, guys. 1989.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, we've got our lineup for the year ahead, and there is quite a number of movies from 1989 that we're going to cover. We've covered some already, and there's plenty more to go, but it really is one of those special years in film that movies just, like, huge movies, but also movies that are a lot of fun, too. So, and this is definitely one of those. When was the first time you guys saw Major League? Brent, did you catch it in the theater?
Oh, I did. Yes, absolutely. I saw it in the theater with my dad. Pretty sure my brother was there. He would have been a little young, but I think because it was a baseball movie and everything, my dad probably let it. I mean, I was only 11, but so I was probably pretty young too. But, you know, other than language, you know, this movie doesn't offer anything too offensive. So yeah, caught it at the movie theater, loved it. You know, I mean, it was great. Like, I just had a great time. I remember walking out of the theater, really enjoying it. I think probably because not only is the movie fun, I was into baseball, you know, my brother was in the we're kind of a baseball family, but also it was an R-rated movie and I was 11 and I was like, yeah, I'm a big kid. I got to see a rated R movie at the theater. And it was a good time. I really enjoyed it. And, this movie holds a little, I have a little soft spot for this one. Even however many years later.
Awesome. Yeah. I can identify with that. David, how about you? First time? No, you've seen this before. I'm not even going to ask.
Give me a break. Yeah, no, I can't recall the first time I saw it. I doubt it was the theater, but this was a mainstay on television forever. So much, and I've seen it so many times. Certainly, maybe not from the very beginning every time, but you know, as soon as I caught it at, you know, minute 10 or 15 when all the characters are introduced and gathering at spring training or tryouts or whatever. Yeah, like I've seen it countless times, but like my rhythm of knowing the movie as actually the curse words were scrubbed, so that like hearing them actually curse in the movie is like, oh yeah, like I don't actually recognize the rhythm of it, although I know I've seen it, like I've seen the R-rated version or whatever, but it's actually funny to like watch it as it is. And as it was originally presented. Yeah, I've seen it so many times, and there's just parts of it that continue to be just ingrained in my brain. And to be honest, I'm not much of a sports fan, but I was playing baseball at that age, and it was just on TV. Everybody loved baseball. I mean, I don't know. And it was probably a great moneymaker for TV affiliates and stuff. So. And with all that star power attached, everybody loved a Sheen.
The Machine.
Loved a Behringer. Right?
Yeah, so. We're all on Team Tom here.
In 89? Definitely.
Yeah.
Would he be the substitute yet? Or is
oh, no.
Is
we're about no, 7 years.
Yeah, not
7
yet.
Years pre-substitute.
Pre-substitute. Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't even know it was that late in the 90s.
The Substitute's probably like his last like good movie, you know, and you can argue that. Like,
not
not everybody loves The Substitute, but
yeah,
fools, fools.
I know. I mean, it only gets better when you get Treat in there. Winner Takes All, School's Out. Those are the sequels. Yeah,
that's right.
I also have a very special place for this movie in my heart, as you mentioned, Brent, but I did not see it in theaters. I opted to see The Dream Team. That's right, the Michael Keaton, Peter Boyle classic, The Dream Team, instead of Major League.
Is Dream Team the one where they escape from like a hospital and they're all bumping into stuff? And yeah, I think I saw that at the theater too.
Yeah, yeah.
You could see more than one movie that weekend.
I don't know. Apparently I couldn't, but no, so I did not see it there. And I must have known of it, but it didn't really hit until later that year when it was on home video. I was in fifth grade and just it was like, you know, when you went to your next grade and sometimes you'd like disc, I don't know if you guys had this, maybe it's just me, but disconnected from some of your friends and you're in your new class and you kind of have to like restart and make a new group of friends. I made what at the time was a like one of my favorite group of friends, you know, one of which is a regular listener to the show. His name's Eamon. And we became friends kind of because of this movie. Like we started talking and, you know, we started kind of hanging out and our first sleepover was we were going to watch Major League. And that was and I fell in love with the movie right there. I was like, oh, my God, how did I miss this movie? Like I was such a huge Charlie Sheen fan at the time with Platoon and The Wraith and Eight Men Out and Young Guns, like big fan. And I was also a huge fan of Tom Berenger because I thought Shoot to Kill, which we covered that on the show and check it out in the archives. I thought he was like super cool in that movie. So I was a big Berenger fan, big Sheen fan. But I didn't see it until it was on video. And then I watched it like over and over and over. I had an art project that I had to do for one of my art classes at the time. And we had to like make a sculpture. So I made the cover of the box, which was like a big, like, I think I did it over like a globe, like made the baseball with the spiked hair and I won something for that. I won a nice certificate for it. So.
You won and a then very I, like, special I, award.
Yeah, very special award. And the item was Fragile too. So
Fragile.
That's Italian. I kind of separated from the movie until we were in college, Brent, and our dear friend Cam, I think, gave me the videotape, and I was like, oh my God, like completely forgot. I went years without even thinking about Major League and fell back in love with it. And I think it's just such a fun movie. I mean, it's really like mostly lighthearted, pretty faithful baseball wise, you know, good cast. It's just, I think, a movie that still, I'll say it, hits a home run.
Yeah. Hits a grand slam.
Sure.
Come on, John, think bigger.
Yeah. So like, you know, digging in a little bit, Brent, you mentioned the underdog story and we talked about that, on our, you know, some of our sports coverage, recently as well. And the underdog story is kind of always one that it's an easy sort of win with the audience, that it's hard for, I mean, you have to really mess something up along the way to have the audience not on board with the underdog story, right? The underdog sports story.
Yeah, yes. I think so. Like, you know, some people, the whole idea is your underdogs, they're not as good as everyone else. And together they're even worse. But there are stakes at play and we want to see them win. It's not just about going through the motions. And there is a journey to be had and different motivations for everybody on a team thing, you know, because a lot of underdog stories are about one character for the most part. So this is like a whole team of basically five guys on the team and then a bunch of 25 other extras.
and Jeremy Piven, who got cut out.
Oh, is he cut out?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. I didn't know he was in the movie at all, but
Jeremy Piven was, well, I guess we're going to talk about it right now. Jeremy Piven was cast in the movie and he was like a bench. I think he was either a bench coach or he was like a player that was on the bench. It was sort of a comic relief character. And they just felt like when the movie came together, it was just really kind of took you out of the moments that they're in. Cause you already have Bob Uecker and you have other things that are kind of balancing that out. So away he went.
So he was fully filmed and in the movie and they just, wow, it's
in
amazing.
This movie?
Yeah.
I can't even imagine where he fits in.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I mean, that's each character has their own foibles and traits and everything. So yeah, once you load it with too many silly things, I guess, yeah, it's probably just a little too heavy. So I can see maybe another wacky character might have really just wasted a lot of time or, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I think to your point, David, it's like every one of the characters seems to have its own little quirk, you know, that everybody and each everybody gets their little section of time where they establish that, you know, and it's not like we spend a whole lot of time with everyone other than the major characters, but every character gets their little beat. And if you were to throw another one in there, yeah, it would be maybe one too many.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be able to develop the Tom Berenger, Rene Russo relationship as much, or, you know, something of that nature. And yeah, makes sense that they lost it for time, I'm sure. But it'd be interesting to see it if they filmed it all, like in some alternate mm-hmm. cut.
Yeah, it's not even on the DVD. You know, it's the no deleted scenes or anything. But they, you know, David Ward talks about it on the commentary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's not on the Wild Thing edition either, which would be right. Probably the best spot to drop it in.
I could go for like a 3.5 hour cut of this movie.
Sure, why not?
Yeah,
I mean,
director's cut, like Napoleon, and
it'd be as long as a real baseball game.
Was there deleted scenes on the Wild Thing edition?
There's a whole alternate ending.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Which we'll get to, because that okay. would get that kind of completely changes the tone. Of...
Oh, yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Not a fan. Crazy.
But yeah, like you were saying, all these characters, the cast is really interesting because it's some people that were at the peak of their career here and some people that are about to take off or going to take off a little further down the road, like Dennis Haysbert. And then you've got great character actors here that, you know, James Gammon and Charles Cyphers and Chelsea Ross that are just guys that you see in movies all throughout. You know, Chelsea Ross was like in Mad Men even, so he was around for such a long time, and I think he still is around. You know, that those character actors always are so important to fill out a really good cast, that they're not the featured players, they don't have the overall storyline, but they're great in the scenes that they're kind of peppered in throughout. And I want to shout out to Margaret Whitten, is just an you know, underappreciated hero of this movie, so she doesn't get enough credit.
She's a great villain.
Yeah. But all our main characters like have the arc, like you were saying too, David, that they get, you know, there's a setup and a payoff for what they're doing, and it comes full circle, and it feels it's a really solid script, and I think David Ward certainly knew what he was doing in putting this whole package together. So yeah, just I love this movie so much. On top of all that, you've got a great Randy Newman song opening the movie, and you open your movie with Randy Newman. Ugh. Got it in the bag.
Okay. Sounds like David's not a fan, but I would say that it's a nice, like, that song immediately makes me invested in like this blue collar, hardworking, you know, kind of environment that the Cleveland Indians are supposed to be, or that, you know, that they're located in. And so, like, I don't know, there's so much like depth and gravel to his voice when he sings, that it's like, I mean, it just feels like Cleveland. Like, even when mm-hmm. I hear other songs that he does, I immediately think of Major League. Like, it,
yeah,
you know, and I mean, this guy's had music in everything. Yeah. So, it, you know, he's been around, you know, for decades and decades. And no matter when I hear it, I'm immediately put back in that place where I'm watching the kids play stickball in the middle of the street in Cleveland at the beginning of this movie. Like, it just immediately takes me there.
And he's so smart that he writes a lot of songs based on cities. So those are winners right there.
Yeah.
No. David Ward actually only, the funny thing is, he only chose that song to open the movie because that was the only song that he knew of that was about Cleveland.
Well, he nailed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, good choice.
No, but it fits perfectly. The way they cut together that montage and really give you that, you know, real feeling of the city, that, like, yeah. real you know, it's almost like it's just B-roll footage of all over the place. But
yeah,
it works so well to get you like, all right, I feel like I'm there. I'm in the rhythm.
Now, David, are you not a Newman fan? Is that?
No. He's all over the place. I mean, I didn't really have too much of a problem with that song or anything like that. It does really fit. I think it tonally gives you a nice little entrance into the city and the story and all that. So yeah, but I don't know, Randy Newman, maybe I'm tired of him after the fact that we have so many of his songs. And
yeah, I mean, once he got put into the Disney machine and was like singing every like Toy Story song and all that, yeah, I mean, it got a little much. But like, you take back then, to 1989, you know, yeah. He had a music career, you know, like he was a
yeah, he's an artist.
Yeah, he was like a performing artist, like a musician, you know, yeah, like on tour and like doing songs, and he'd done that for years.
Yeah,
and you know, it wasn't until I don't even know it was. He probably was already doing film by the time he did this movie, but
yes,
it had to be pretty early on in his you know, movie career. I would think, but I don't know for sure.
I'm probably just more or less of a fan of his later work that's in film all over the place.
Like, yeah, David, when
although
I
you
walk
got a
by,
friend in me, like
yeah, when I walk by your office here at Recon Cinema Studios, the Toy Story soundtrack is usually blasting every Tuesday and Thursday.
That's the wrong office. That's the janitor.
Oh, that's the janitor.
You're right next door.
He has an office next to me. Yeah, because. I'm so filthy that when he walks out of his office to start his shift, he has to spend about 2 or 3 hours in my office. So
true.
So he doesn't want that long walk.
Well, let's talk about the development of the movie. David Ward was a big writer at this point in his career. He had wrote The Sting. He'd won an Oscar for The Sting. He wrote the Milagro Beanfield War and had a good relationship with Robert Redford. And it's that relationship that convinced Morgan Creek to finance this film, which is his passion project, Major League. And he grew up a big baseball fan in Cleveland. And he kind of figured the only way that Cleveland was going to win the World Series was if he made a movie about them winning the World Series.
That's...
Yeah.
You know, right. He's a fantasy writer, really.
Yeah,
that's how exactly. He's
fan fiction. I love it.
The funny thing was that, you know, just not too many years down the road, the Cleveland's going to get really good and make it to the World Series a number of times.
Yeah, but it was like two decades later, wasn't it? It wasn't.
No, it was like in the mid 90s that they were, or maybe early 90s that they were with Albert Bell, like when they first started to. David, are you looking it up?
No.
Oh, I look like you were.
You're doing all sorts of stuff.
Anyway.
Mission Control runs through David.
Yeah, I think that's when they got big, was just at like by, I think, 96-ish, you know, somewhere around the mid-90s when they started.
That was during my downtime of baseball. There was a chunk of my life, probably about 5 or 6 years, I like stopped following baseball for a minute and I was like not paying attention. So it might have been there.
Was that the beginning of the Craig Biggio, Jeff Bagwell years in Houston?
It was in the middle of that. I mean, Craig Biggio started in the late 80s.
Oh yeah, that's right.
With the Astros. And Bagwell wasn't too far behind, but it was kind of all the same because there was the strike in, was it 95? I think.
Yeah, 4 or 5. Yep.
Yeah. And so when that happened, I kind of lost interest because I'm for those who don't know, huge Astros fan. And the Astros were killing it that year. Bagwell was having an MVP year, like everything was going on. And then the strike happened and it put an end to it. And it was like so disappointing that I just lost my taste for baseball for a few years. But it came roaring back.
Yep, I hear you. I'm the same way. I'm kind of in and out every so often. So,
well, yeah, actually, you know, Cleveland Indians had the winningest season of all the teams in the '96 season. So yeah, yep. they got knocked out in the division series by Baltimore, but they were hot shit.
Yeah. They were always, I mean, it was always, you know, I felt like the Yankees were chasing them and were kind of dancing around them, you know, year after year around that time. So,
yeah.
but maybe this kickstarted it. Maybe this got the energy in the right direction. So, thank you, David Ward, for giving Cleveland the boost that it needed.
That's right.
you know, and I think it was so, it worked so well to set the movie in Cleveland. I mean, you could set it because it's like Cleveland feels like a working man's town, right? Like, you know, having it be like the Dodgers or, you know, or even the Yankees or, you know, something like that. I think it doesn't have the same heart that this one has. Maybe you could have used like the Brewers, the Milwaukee Brewers, or the Pittsburgh Pirates or something, and you'd still kind of buy it as that underdog team that.
Yeah. I don't mean this in any kind of, look, I've never even been to Cleveland, but like it has a very down and out kind of vibe to it, Cleveland. And it's kind of the perfect city about a sports team that's down and out. Right.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, absolutely.
They just kind of fit perfect. And I think you're right. The Brewers could have done it, you know, maybe Pittsburgh.
But like, but yeah, you don't Cleveland get that same
perfect.
Yeah. You don't get that vibe from like, oh, Atlanta, you know, or.
Yeah. I wouldn't even say like Chicago, like the Cubs, because they're too like, there's an allure to them, you know, like it's just like, there's just not, you know.
Well, like, it was such a thing for the Cubs. Like it was such a thing that they haven't won. It was like, they were almost just as popular. It felt like, maybe I didn't live there, so maybe that's not true. David, you spent time in Chicago. It felt like they were almost as popular as like the Yankees and the Dodgers and whoever else because they hadn't won.
Yeah, they had a passionate fan base.
Yeah,
kind of like the Dodgers fans of recent times, pre World Series. Didn't they just win like last year, something like that? Did the Dodgers won
in 2020, the shortened season. People say it's a fluke, kind of a joke because it was such a circus of a season.
Right, but right.
The Dodgers can keep trying.
Oh, okay. I guess you're all right.
Look
I wasn't supporting the Dodgers.
No, I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying, you know, they can throw money at Shohei Ohtani and whoever else they're going to circle into their little
That's
world.
Crazy.
And, you know, like they, it's not like they haven't spent a ton of money yet and still they're great at doing really good during the season and then sitting on the couch come the second round of the playoffs.
That's, you know, honestly, as big of a
Shots
Yankees
fired,
fan,
LA.
Yeah. As big of a Yankees fan as I am, that's part of the problem I've had with that team is, you know, you're and it's been going on for a long time that you're buying all this talent that doesn't necessarily make a great team. That,
oh yeah,
you know,
right.
I miss the old days of like a team forms and they stay together for years until, you know, whatever, people start moving on or get traded or whatever. But like, it's not, you're not signing people for like one season deals and you never have that time to gel as a team. That's why the 96 Yankees, you know, it took two seasons prior to that to like build into that. And then they basically stayed together for another 3, 4, 5 seasons, something like that, before everyone started either retiring or, you know, started kind of moving down the roster. But it's very rare to see that now, especially with the bigger teams.
Yeah.
The Yankees spent $152 million last season. What the fuck? That's so much money. Like, the Tampa Bay Devil Rays spent $19 million on payroll last season.
Yeah.
They
it's
were
kind of crazy.
Had a terrible record and all that. But Jesus. How many World Series has the Yankees won in the last 20 years? 4? Like, right?
Something like that, yeah.
Isn't it something terrible? Like, and they're spending billions of dollars?
I mean, but they're still the winningest baseball team, World Series-wise, in history. But that's going back, you know, almost 100 years.
That's so. Legacy
they're also,
stuff.
They're also one of 5 teams that have been around since the beginning of baseball.
Exactly,
So I gotcha. Congratulations.
The Black Sox are coming back. I'm calling it now.
Oh my God.
If only this If only this Cleveland team was a real team, man, that would be the thing.
I'd love to see Wild Thing Ricky Vaughn on the mound.
Oh, yeah.
Come on.
But, you know, so in talking about this team again, let's dig in a little bit more with our, you know, with the actors and the characters that they, you know, I feel like everyone is so likable. Even a guy like Roger Dorn is likable. He's just so, like, you kind of love to hate him.
He's a total prick, but at the same time, like, he's like your team's prick, right? Like, you're like, okay, like, he's that guy.
But these guys feel, oh, go ahead, David.
I could see like Corbin Burnson as Roger Dorn, like seeing him getting needled by like, I feel like they're like, I can tell there is stuff cut out of this movie. You don't even know that like half the team lives together until like the final act because Vaughn sleeps with Dorn's wife or whatever.
Right.
But there was no indication that they're a team that socializes other than that one time the three main characters went to dinner. Like, they, you know what I mean? So it's, you know, so I could see Dorn, you know, getting needled by like a Piven character, a sarcastic little scamp making trouble for Dorn. Meanwhile, he's got the rivalry with Vaughn and wow. Each character could have so much more going on, and it's like they're stuffed into this movie, you know, and they're fun.
Yeah. Well, what also going back to the Dorn character, just as far as like him being a dick and like, you know, you're kind of like, whatever. I think the fact that like Lou Brown establishes at the beginning that he's not going to put up with his shit by just, you know, basically pissing all over his contract and saying you know,
and he's the perfect toughen guy up, to
buttercup.
Be.
Like,
yeah. You know,
take the bounce, like get in there.
It's so great. I mean, he's like all these characters feel like extensions of actual people. Like they're exaggerated versions of,
sure,
you know, real people with character. So
yeah,
it doesn't feel like, all right, maybe Dennis Haysbert is a little bit far-fetched, but the rest of them, you could buy it that there are, you know, there are people like this.
Well, I mean, they're all a little bit like caricatures of that thing. So like, I mean,
but it works.
Willie Mays Hayes, you know, like every single one of them, the most grounded character is probably Tom Berenger's character, Jake, or Rene Russo or whatever, like, but that's intentional. You know, everybody else is kind of an amplified version of somebody or someone that you would see on a baseball team or within your friend group or whatever. And so, you know, like it's kind of funny to see them cranked up to 11. And that's also what helps Jake feel so grounded, right? Because he's like very much like average Joe, old man, like, you know, end of his career, just trying to figure out what's next.
Yeah. I mean, his storyline is the most touching one in the movie because it's so real. Like that is the reality for baseball players that, or athletes in general, that, you know, as it goes on, their body is going to start failing them and age is going to catch up with them, and they're not going to be, you know, they've got competition from all the young people coming in, and what do they do? What do they have left?
Yeah. I would say that extends beyond baseball though. I think that's with any person that's getting older, you know, like as they're, as they're facing retirement or whatever, you know, like, you know, it's just, it's a changing of the guard, and it's like, okay, well, where am I going? What do I find important now? Like, where are my priorities?
Well, the difference with athletes is it's going to hit much younger, you know, like, and then the harder contact sports are going to be even younger. So, you know, football players are like retiring in their mid 30s. Baseball players can make it to, you know, mid 40s or something, depending on what position you are. And that's a, you know, generalizing it, but you know, hockey players, football players are like, they're going to be retiring much younger. Baseball players, basketball players can go a little bit further, but
how old was Jake Taylor's character in this? Do you think?
I don't know exactly.
Like late 30s, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, he's got to be like.
He looks 57. Like, I mean, he's like, you know, no offense.
We call that the Berenger effect.
Yeah.
Well, Berenger was only 40 when he shot this. He was 39 when he shot.
But dude looks like he's made of leather. And like, you know, I mean, it's just like, he's, you know, he's a, He definitely has a weathered look, right? Like, yeah. So yeah. That's what I'm trying to figure out. Is he like 45? Cause that would be extremely old. I feel like for a catcher just in general in baseball. Cause that's especially in the '80s, that's an abusive spot, yeah. You know, like yeah. Crouching, getting steamrolled, you know, they've changed the rules and everything in baseball now. So it's not as potentially high impact, but still, man, like that's a brutal spot to be in, getting pounded yeah. with baseballs and all that. So I don't know. Like, I was just kind of curious.
Yeah. I mean, I felt like he was somewhere in the range of like 38 to 42, you know, on the high end.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, his storyline I think is the one that you emotionally get behind the most, that, you know, it's really grounded in reality. And his, you know, this is when Tom was really at the peak of his career. And I think acting wise, this is one of his best characters. And, you know, you right from the beginning, you see like he's isn't he in Mexico and like whatever league? And
yeah, it's like in Juarez or somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's the script though takes a complete shortcut because it's like he's making a living more or less, I guess, as in the Mexican league, still drinking and sleeping around. He doesn't have any kind of like foundation or whatever. And then he just suddenly like, well, he's back in Cleveland where the love of his life is. And it's not, we just follow him. Like he may as well be just pursuing her for dating, but it's like, we don't really see some like indication that he's ready to settle down and fix his life. Like,
well, doesn't he say as much?
Well, yeah, he says it.
Yeah, I feel like he says it in the movie where he's like I'm trying to, like, this is the, you know, like I'm back here. It's giving me another opportunity, but like I'm trying to straighten up and like settle.
Yeah, exactly.
But we don't.
It's
have
his
any...
last shot. It's his last yeah. shot at cleaning up his life and giving it, you know, a run in the big leagues and a healthy lifestyle. Like, it's his one last chance at it.
For sure. Oh, totally. I mean, look, I get it. Like, it's a comedy. We don't have to spend much time on the drama of it. But like, character wise, it's like, trust us. This is what's going on. You know, because yeah. I don't.
Oh, yeah.
I don't believe it. You know, you don't tell. You show. Right. That's right. The point. So yeah. While it's, but again, I think this movie's kind of long enough as it is. So it's just cut to the chase. You know, and I think it works because of just the charm of everyone. And you believe the characters are feeling what they're talking about. So you don't need it for the sake of brevity, I guess it's the point.
Well, yeah. Well, we spend the most time with Jake Taylor. He's the only one that we for really sure. spend time in his personal life.
Yeah. I mean, it's his story, right? Like, I mean, yep. when it all yeah. boils down to it.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Like, I don't feel like even saying that though, like, I feel some kind of connection to all of the team, right? Like, they do a really good job of really like
humanizing everybody.
Well, humanizing and you know, getting a lot of value out of what little time each person has to have the movie focus on them. And I think it's done really, you know, in a way that's really effective.
Yeah. I mean, he's your lead. He's the one that's going to ground you in the story. We spend the most time with him. We follow him. But like, Wild Thing, Ricky is like the star who's going to the hero of the movie. But you've got like Wesley Snipes and Willie Mays Hayes is like sort of the comic relief. But I mean, the dude launches his career off this movie.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But well, this...
Just like launching off first base to steal second, Wesley takes yeah. off for the stratosphere.
I mean, it's crazy. Like you mentioned it earlier that I mean, you said Dennis Haysbert or whatever is as, you know, it being a platform for him to launch his career. But really, like Wesley Snipes, you know, this dude soared into stardom, you know, kind of post this movie. Yeah, it's kind of incredible to think about because the characters that he got kind of famous for playing and being are way different
way
than
different.
This character, you know, and he's yeah. great in this. Like he's really good as this character, but man, he's not knowing for being like comic relief or, you know, like, I mean, he's a, yeah. he's, he goes in and he whoops ass. Like
he, that's what Wesley Snipes does. He's the one that got the most out of this movie, for sure. Right. That it's, you know, he launched this. Then he's got New Jack City and Jungle Fever and White Man Can't Jump. You know, and then
Blues,
Passenger 57, of course. Don't forget that one. Drop Blade, Zone. Come on,
Blade. Like
yes,
yeah.
Until he ran into some legal trouble, he had quite the run. But
he's been in things recently that have been pretty good too, though.
Yeah, like, he's on a comeback right now.
Yeah.
But yeah, and it's funny because you don't see him when you look at the poster for this movie. It's like he's not on there, and it's kind of weird to see because his character Willie Mays Hayes is so memorable and has such a great. Mm-hmm. Great like entry into this movie, and like during the tryouts when, you know, he's cocky, shows up in a Rolls Royce in this beautiful suit and shoes and everything, and like they don't well,
it's
give
not
a shit.
It's not a Rolls Royce, it's a friggin' well, Volkswagen yeah. Bug with a conversion on it to make it look like a Rolls
look
Royce
like a Rolls Royce.
It's hilarious.
That's true. But when they like, you know, kick him out, right, and he wakes up late for practice, and they're already like doing the rate, you know, the they're already sprinting. 40-yard
sprint, yeah.
Yep, and then he just turns around and like hustles like right ahead. Beautiful, beautiful moment.
Yeah, it's great.
And you get great comedy during the season where he's trying, you know, he's starting to find his rhythm of stealing the base, and like the first couple of times he's like comes up short, and there's, you know, some good moments in there where we see his skills kind of building. But let's talk about the machine, Charlie Sheen.
Charlie Sheen.
Already a star.
The machine is back on Reconcinimation. Controversial human, but boy, do we enjoy some of his movies.
He was less controversial in 89.
Oh yeah,
I think maybe it just hadn't surfaced yet, but the controversy was definitely happening at this point.
Probably, yeah. I think he's pretty widely talked about how he used to use steroids for this project so that he could get in shape for the characters. So yeah, I would say the machine was already geared up and ready to go. But
yeah.
I don't know if there was tiger blood involved at this point or anything of that nature, but he was definitely, I mean, this dude grew up in Hollywood, you know? So it's like, I mean, he probably had a pretty skewed perspective of everything from the get go.
Yeah. And he's somebody else that, like Berenger, he's really at the peak of his career. This is him coming off of Platoon, coming off of Wall Street. Those are still probably two of his, or if not his two biggest movies, they're right up there. But now he's kind of like shifting gears a little bit, right? That he's like getting a little lighter. He's done the heavy kind of awards movies. This is going to be fun, maybe a more box office friendly movie. And what I always found funny back then was that, you know, he's coming off Platoon with Tom Berenger, where they are characters that despised each other in the movie and were very, they went through an emotional like journey during the making of that movie, and because of the content and the characters that they were playing, that to turn around 2 years later and like do this light comedy where they're buddies like was very surreal for me.
I wonder how surreal it was for them.
According to, I'm not sure how Tom felt, but according to Charlie, he was like, he was relieved. Like he's like, all right, we did all that, now let's just go have a good time. So
yeah.
I think they were both into it, and but it was like just bizarre. I don't know why, like in the mid late 80s I was so into G.I. Joe and war and stuff. Like I watched Platoon a lot, and it was just like, I don't know, it was very weird for me to see that. Like if only Willem Dafoe played Roger Dorn, this would have been perfect.
Yeah,
I don't know, that would be a different kind of shortstop.
Yeah. But yeah, and really Charlie would only have another couple of years where he's kind of riding high with the Hot Shots movies around the corner. But if you look at his you know, resume, it really starts to go on the downswing not too long after this movie. So,
yeah, and it really wouldn't pick would back up moments. Until Two and a Half Men, right?
Right.
And that's when he was catapulted again, right?
Yeah, and he probably made more money off Two and a Half Men than everything else before that, but
probably still does.
Yeah. But yeah, and his character was based on Mitch Williams. Does anybody remember Mitch Williams, who played, wasn't he on, oh, he's on the Texas Rangers and then I think the Phillies, I believe.
Couldn't tell you.
Yeah, he was.
but, wild man Mitch Williams.
Yeah, he was a real wild character. And I don't think he was like an advisor on this, but the character was definitely based on him. And Charlie did not want to have his hair cut, you know, with the cool stylings on the back. Yeah.
Oh, man, that's such a great haircut.
Yeah. But Ricky Vaughn has such a good arc as well that we don't see him as much, which was weird that Charlie Sheen is probably the biggest name on this movie. I would say just above Berenger, but we don't really see as him with as much screen time as we do Tom. But we see him as that fresh out of jail, which is like the first comic moment that they're getting
California Penal League.
Yeah, they're so desperate to get people from anywhere that they'll take them from prison. And he's got that arc where he's got to settle down and he's got to get serious about, his career, because this is for everybody. This is their one shot. And if he's got to clean up too. And then later on that we see he's got the problem with the eyesight that, finally when he gets the glasses, which he's afraid are going to, of how he's going to look with them, that's what helps everything kind of come together.
Yeah.
And of course that moment of, when Wild Thing hits and he comes in to as the relief pitcher, one of the best, that's like one of my favorite sports moments.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's funny. When I watched it this time, I was watching it with my son and it was a little dicey with the language and everything, but he's the same age as I was when I saw it. And he loved it, man. He got totally into it because he pitches and he's into that. So he's all for Wild Thing. And, this was fun, man. It was good. It was good to see it kind of go from generation to generation and have him enjoy the movie. Cause he does, he's not a big movie guy. And So if I can get him to watch something and enjoy it, it's always a win for me. So, but yeah, he really enjoyed the Wild Thing character. Cause like you were saying, Charlie Sheen kind of plays, sort of the younger guys. So, I think even though he's much older than my son is, I think since my son's a pitcher, he probably, could relate in some way, but
yeah,
it was good.
Well, there's something too relating to this movie because you've played baseball, like an organized baseball. Like, I mean, I think not every kid, and particularly boys, obviously, not every kid is played baseball growing up in an organized way. But I have a feeling almost all who are capable, like physically capable of, have swung a bat or, rounded the bases at some point, and
sure.
So like, but being on a team for even a small period of time, you do get the culture a little bit, it's obviously different. Like pro sports is different, but there are things about it that still felt very familiar to me. Just even understanding understanding the basics of the game and the fielding and the batting and the order and all that stuff, and just like understanding there's certain ways how to play to win. So being on a team, and I was terrible. I was absolutely awful. I couldn't hit the ball, and my fielding was terrible, and I can't run. But hey, that's why I kept playing, right? To bootstrap myself into a better person.
I don't think you have to be good at baseball to find it alluring, right? Like anybody can stand at the plate and pretend like they're hitting a home run and round the bases. And in that moment, using your imagination, feel like you just won the World Series, right? In the bottom of the ninth. And it's like, you know, I mean, it's, there's something about that. Like, I mean, it's kind of fun to do. Now, if you go out and you play with the team and you're like out there doing it, like, sure, like you're going to get other bits of it, but like just kind of imagining going out there and stepping up and being the mighty Casey up to bat, you know, it's, there's something fun about it. And, you know, some imagination that you can kind of pull into it to get kind of a kick out of just, like you said, David, rounding the bases. Right. So, you know, I mean, I don't think you have to be good. I was not a very good baseball player. I played for a couple of years in Little League, but it was like, you know, I still look back at it fondly, even though, you know, like I didn't play for long.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just something about it. Like, and the thing is like, I mean, even at the time there were times where I absolutely hated it and I didn't know why I was playing, but at the end of the season, it was still like, I guess I was happy that, you know, that I had done it, but, or have fond memories of it or whatever. So there is, I think, I mean, baseball is you know, I don't know. American culture has a lot of things, you know, you have a lot of things about American culture, but this is probably like one of the longest lasting, consistent and like universal American cultural thing. It's baseball. I mean, like, you know, that's that phrase. It's as American as apple pie and baseball, right? Isn't that, or something like that, or baseball? Yeah. So it's like everyone can kind of relate to a baseball tale, and that's, you know, I think doesn't Field of Dreams come out the same year?
I think it's 88. I think it's before this. Yeah.
So, you know, these like films to that baseball connects people with teammates or with their family, you know, their dads, and it's a, you know, it is a very male sport, you know. Because we only really watch men play it, but everyone likes it. And I get why there's 162 games a year, because it's just anything could really happen. It's not the 16 weeks of the NFL or whatever.
Yeah, like, well, and you play it for as much of the year with good weather as you can. You know, they play it right till when it's too cold to really keep going.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, now that I have kids, dude, like one of my favorite things to do in the world is to go into the backyard and throw the ball with my son, you know, or the ball with my daughter. You know, she's starting to play softball. And so, you know, like it's awesome just to go out there and play catch with the kids, dude. Like it's great. And you don't need anything, you know, like you glove and a ball. Like,
yep, it's easy.
I think when I moved to Chicago, like a couple of years after college, and then I think as soon as I moved there, I actually made a point to go buy a baseball glove just in case someone wants to play baseball or play catch or something. And it's been in my closet ever since. And I've moved with it. I haven't used it once. I think I used it once in the time I bought it.
Next time we're around each other, we're going to throw the ball.
As soon as we wrap here, let's just go out.
Yeah. Let's go outside to the parking lot and throw the ball around.
There's nothing more like not me than to own a baseball glove. But I think as an American male, I have to.
You never know when you're going to be walking down the street and a game picks up at the Sandlot and they need a ninth.
I'm going to get my glove.
Go grab your glove, Munchak. It's time to go, buddy.
I have a feeling that glove will get used again before I die, but we'll see.
Oh, it will. I will see you before you die.
Okay.
We will definitely be throwing the ball.
All right.
We mentioned Corbin Burnson. Corbin Burnson at this time was a huge star. He was like, LA Law was one of the top shows on TV, and he was, you know, one of the, I think, in the top three actors in that show. So kind of forget that Corbin Burnson was such a big name at the time. He's become more of a character actor, but
you also, you know, at that time though, there was a pretty large gap between TV and film, you know, like I feel like to jump from television to film, like a big star in TV wouldn't be as recognized in film in Hollywood. And that's less so these days. Like it seems like people bounce around to everything, doing commercials, it doesn't matter. But like in the 80s and 90s and whatnot, like there was kind of a much clearer division, you know, like it was kind of a different section of the Hollywood entertainment industry.
Yeah, for sure. It was not, I mean, very rarely did we see someone jump over. We did see Tom Selleck make that jump with Three Men and a Baby and Runaway, of course.
When you have a mustache like that, buddy, you can do whatever the fuck you want.
Tom Selleck, who would do Mr. Baseball a few years later.
That's right.
Wow.
So, but yeah, Corbin, great in this role. And he's, I think the bit of trivia is he's the only actor to be in all three of the major league films.
It says that Dennis Haysbert was in the third one. I don't remember the third one.
I don't remember him in it. Maybe he is.
He's got a, maybe. He might have, maybe he has an appearance.
Yeah, maybe.
And I would argue, even though he's not really acting, Bob Uecker is also in all three movies, but.
There you go.
But he's playing Bob Uecker. So
right.
More or less, like, yeah. You know, because he was Bob Uecker, of course, a former athlete and this and one of the star of Mr. Belvedere, you know, became an actor. But then he was still calling games, right? For
For the Brewers.
Is Bob Uecker still alive? I think he's still calling.
I think he's still calling. For the Brewers. That's right.
Yeah. He's still around.
If he's alive, he's doing it. Like that guy's definitely woven into the fabric of baseball.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's so important in this movie. He's almost serves as the narrator, sort of, that he is sort of the voice walking us through this movie and summarizing what's happening with them. We're seeing it too, but he's also kind of framing it for us and doing it hilariously. And he's such a great, his character is so great.
And he's so well written too. Yeah, I don't know if he was improvising at all. Like, was there anything in the commentary about his performance?
Or he had input into, you know, what his character's dialogue was going to be, that so that it would feel natural coming from him.
Yeah.
But, well, it's good to have him and also the kind of the outfield stooges. I don't know, but but like you got to have those two kind of like groups of characters in there so that you get that sort of temperature of the fans and how they're doing, you know? So I think it's always great when they cut away in the movie and it's like, you're in like the diner and it's like two guys talking about the team. And it's, you get those check-ins with the fans who are also us, the audience. Right. And they're kind of like establishing the emotional, like where we're supposed to be in our emotional journey as we're watching the movie. And it's
And the father and son groundskeeper, like they're good frames to bounce us as the audience our feelings off of.
Yeah,
and one of those guys in the outfield is Neil Flynn, who would go on to be in Scrubs and The Middle and a big television star later on.
He's more like he played that construction worker guy.
Oh, the construction worker. Yeah.
And then he was in the bar at the end. But
That's
the thing. We kept revisiting all of, like these characters that you'd probably, anyone who makes commentary about what a team is supposed to do, it's just that's how the city differentiates or talks about their team, you know? Mm-hmm. They're shitty. Yeah. Oh, they've got something. Ah, they're still shitty. Like,
I
mean, you go to any sport. I mean, you go to any sports thread or on X or Bleacher Report or whatever, and you read through the fan comments and it's the same shit. It's just digital now. Like when the team does good, everybody's like, this team's the best. They're going all the way. And then they lose a game and it's like, fucking bums. It's hilarious, man.
Yep.
Yeah, the fans will turn on you if you are not good.
Deliver or die, like that's like the mentality. It's crazy.
Dennis Haysbert, we mentioned, who would work a year later with Charlie Sheen again in a lot of connections to Charlie Sheen all over the place, but in Navy SEALs, which we covered, check it out in the archives at reconcinimation.com. Let's put a pin in that. I want to come back to everything Jobu related in a minute. Mm-hmm. A good performance, character is the question mark, but Haysbert would go on it really wasn't until he hit the 24 that he really got big. And then what, the Allstate commercials, yeah, I think.
And the Allstate commercials.
Yeah, David Palmer, Senator, then President David Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
The first black president of America.
Yep, that's true.
If you, you know.
James Gammon as Lou, the coach. I love James Gammon. Dude. Like, what a great character actor. His character here, his voice. Just how, like, he doesn't take any guff from anybody.
Is he not the greatest manager in fictional baseball lore ever? Like, he's just like, he is the epitome of that role. Like, it's, he's so good in this.
They couldn't have cast that any better. And there was a few other actors that they kind of batted around a little bit. Like Mitchell Ryan was somebody they were considering for that, who I love too, but Gammon's the better fit here.
Yeah, something about that gravel and that, like, there's like a twangy gravel. I don't know, man. The voice is just like iconic.
And then we have Charles Cyphers, who we recognize from all of our early John Carpenter films, that he is trying to be the voice of reason with. And here she is, Rachel Phelps, played by Margaret Whitten. We mentioned it earlier, great. But. She's so great. I mean, she's great in Secret of My Success. She's great here. She was a great actress that I think, for whatever reason, maybe it was, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I'm assuming Hollywood sexism may have had something to do with it. Of why didn't she become a bigger star? She is so fantastic in this role.
I do not have an answer for you, but yeah, I also feel slighted and quite peeved by it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, she is so strong as that villain she's taken over the team and she's trying to basically push them down into to the worst team in the league so she can relocate them and, you know, take a big financial, make a big winning off of the team. But, and the twist is in the alternate ending. If anyone hasn't seen it, the big reveal in that, and thank God they didn't put it in the movie, was that in the last scene, she's going to come down and reveal herself as having wanted the team to win the whole time. And she was just doing all this to manipulate them into becoming the winners that they are, and that she really loves them and she's supported them the whole time. So
really? Like, genuinely?
Yes. Yep. Like, that's legit.
Like, she wasn't still a villain, but it was like, well, just kidding. I didn't, like, you know,
no. It was, no. Like, she did no, all no. this research. She put together this team that she thought she was going to win, but she just couldn't afford anything. That's why she wouldn't fix anything. Like, they were just broke. They were bankrupt.
Oh, God. It was bad. A terrible twist. That's bad. Yeah, sucks.
Yeah, it would have.
Well, it didn't play well.
Yeah. It would have undercut the whole movie.
Test audiences. Yeah. Test audiences were like, no, we want her to be the villain.
And especially how villainous she is. She's not just casually villainous. She's like, she's such a, like, a bad person, you know, like,
well, right.
Like, you know, because she's just scheming in the background. And,
well, and yeah. to take that out, like it undermines the whole movie. Like, it undermines the whole, like, the down and out underdogs rising up to not only, like, beat the better teams in the league, but beat this overall, like, entity that is trying to purposefully keep them down. Like, and to switch that just, like, is like, it totally erases, I think, the heart of the movie. So yeah, I'm glad they didn't stick with that.
Yeah. And her character is based on Georgia Frontier, who was the person who took over the LA Rams, took him out of LA, moved him to St. Louis. And there's some similarities to that situation here.
Yeah.
Are there any other ladies in this movie?
One, and it's her first movie, Rene Russo.
Hey.
Yeah.
There's actually more than first one movie. Other lady, but yes, Rene Russo.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. Rene Russo's first movie, she just kind of switched over from her modeling career, and I think she's great for her first performance. I mean, this is something I was going to get into with more of the, like, not as great part of the movie that, you know, the portrayal of women in general is part of the problematic stuff here. You know, there's a few things, like the women are either sort of the bitchy boss, the, you know, I don't know if she, damsel in distress may not be the right phrase for Rene Russo's character, but she is someone who does not have a fully formed character as all the male characters do, right? And she's there to be the foil to Jake Taylor's character, and it's really like she says no to him over and over and over, and he just doesn't accept it and forces his way in.
Yeah, the best she ever had was the serial cheater, like, and it wasn't like he was cheating because like they had problems. It's like, no, he was an athlete and he was young, so of course he can F around. Like, he's like, come on, don't, what are you, whoa, what's the problem here? Come on, we were athletes, we're hot. What are you gonna do? It's like, she's like, and I mean, not that that should make him a complete villain or whatever, but like, oh, the best she's ever gonna do is not the, like, her own career and this, you know, someone else with like a path to six, quote unquote, success and all of that. It's the guy who never really understood what her value was in the first place. And now that he has almost nothing left, that's when he gets desperate to say, no, I need to get my life together. You were the best I ever had, which is probably true. So yeah, it's a slight disservice to the character on that, but you know, this is the guys' movie for guys who play sports and like movies.
Mm-hmm. movies for guys who like movies.
You want them, we've got them. Movies for guys who like movies. 10:05 Eastern tonight, only on the Superstation.
Yeah. but she does great in the role, and at least she's the only woman that isn't serially objectified, I think, throughout the whole thing.
Yeah. You know, Roger Dorn, Roger Dorn's wife in this movie, feel like that's something that doesn't age as well either. That, I mean, it's understandable, like, what her character does, but, you know, and that she's watching their, like, you know, news coverage of their win, and she sees in the background that Roger's, like, leaving the party with another woman, and clearly, like, what they're going to be up to. As a matter of revenge, you know, spices herself up, goes out and seduces Charlie Sheen's character Rick, and, you know, spends the night with him, which is then revealed when she, like, wakes up the next morning, tells him, and then walks out the door right past Jake.
I mean,
it's a power move. I love it.
I think it's a power move for sure, dude. Like, I don't think
such a great power
move. Like, it's cold and calculated, but at the same time, like, good for her, dude. Fuck yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think we, as an audience, we feel like in full support of that move because Roger Dorn's a dick and deserves it. But it's the way, you know, using herself as a sex object that is objectifying.
I guess, but she,
from today's mindset,
she made the choice to do it. I don't think it's I mean, it's written by a guy or whatever, but the character weaponizes her sexual appeal to screw over her husband.
Use it to her advantage. Like, I feel like I feel like it's a total boss move.
She's the biggest feminist in the movie.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
I don't hate on that at all. I agree the Rene Russo character is, like, underutilized, and to David's point, like, this is a movie about, I mean, it's a movie about baseball, and, you know, like, the focus isn't going to be on the female character arcs, you know, but like, dude, I think Dorn's wife is a badass, like, total, a total fucking badass. I mean, think about it. Like, this shit happens all the time. Like, it's a long time ago now, but, like, this stuff has been in the news before many times. And it's like, you know, when, like, I think it's kick ass that she went and was like, okay, if you're going to do that, I'm going to do it with the person that you least want me to do it with. Yeah. And I'm going to fucking shove it in your face, you douchebag. Like, fuck
I'm
going to
sleep with your rival. It's like, it's almost worse than sleeping with your best friend, you know? Like, but that Suzanne Dorn was played by Stacey Carroll. Her only other acting credit is on a short lived TV show that it was Rene Russo was, I guess, either a recurring or a regular on called Sable.
Same.
So before Major League, Rene Russo was on a TV show, and she just had, and Stacey Carroll only had like a one-off, you know, guest star role as woman in bar or something like that, or woman
victim.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, but that's really funny, but that's her only two acting credits, and both of them are with Rene Russo. Who knew?
So funny. Yeah. I hear you guys. That's a very fair argument about, you win.
Lady power.
Yeah. But let's talk about Dennis Haysbert's character a little further, Serrano and the Jobu character. That's something that I feel like, you know, anytime we see kind of like traditional like voodoo type stuff, like that doesn't age well now. It just feels like a product of the 80s.
Yeah, I really don't know much about the religion. And the practices and all that. I know Jobu is a fabrication of like what really goes on and all that, but it's just sort of like this made up mysticism because he's just this voodoo guy from Cuba. So I don't know what I'm sure it's. I don't know if it's like, I don't know how it's offensive or whatever, but I know it's probably inaccurate and not good representation otherwise. So it's a little weird.
It's funny as fuck, though.
But funny.
So sorry, voodoo people.
Fuck you, Jobu. Come on, man.
And the balance against Chelsea Ross's character, like, oh, that's great. It's great fuel for them. All these, you know, they have to, like, they're pitting, they're creating all these, like, dramatic situations between characters, you know, between those two and then Rick and Dorn, that at the end, they all have to, like, they're forced to come together and unite as a team. It all builds to that.
It's a team of odd couples, man. And they've all got to work through their shit so that they can come together and beat the Yankees and / beat the villain. Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like, yeah, the Jobu stuff is probably heavy, but we've already said that everybody in this is a caricature of a thing. Right. So it's not, you know, I mean, like everybody's a target in this thing, you know, and like if you're going to get on board with one aspect of it, like I feel like you should get on board with all of it because Jobu wins in the end, dude. I mean, Jobu wins in the end.
Oh, well, Serrano, you know, Serrano did it himself. You know, yeah. But Jobu got him to the big game.
Right. Jobu threw the bat at the back of the dude's head, though. I would say oh, that's a big victory.
That's true. He got his revenge on.
Yeah,
on
you don't touch Jobu's rum.
That's right.
On Harris, right? That was Chelsea Ross's character.
Yes.
Yeah, Chelsea Ross. Who's great. What else have I seen him in? I remember he would pop up and stuff, and I'm like, that's the guy from Major League. I don't know him.
He's in a million things.
Yeah, he's just that character actor.
Yeah.
He's in a bunch. Bill and Ted's, Bogus Journey, Hoosiers. He was in Basic Instinct. Like, he's kind of all over the place.
He's in Drag Me to Hell. He's in Mad Men later on in his career. Yeah, he's been in quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, he's still in shit like Billions and freaking Elementary. And, you know, I mean,
Gene Hackman's The Package.
Ooh.
Gene Hackman's The Package. Did you just say Gene Hackman's Package? Like,
maybe.
Good God, John.
Great actor. Just like James Gammon, I put them in kind of the same category.
Yeah.
But overall, like the I think the movie just comes together, but it's through these characters that, you know, you're buying all this, the drama between the characters that's building that as the team is getting better and better. And it's this, you know, like we said, the underdog story is a formula that works. And I don't think, I've seen versions of it that are way worse. This is a very effective way of telling that story.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even the way you structured that sentence. I've seen versions that are way worse. That makes this sound not good, but that's not what you're saying. This is good.
No, not at all. Yeah.
This is very good.
This is like one of the best versions of it that I think, if you're looking for a baseball movie, like for me, this is one of my, I don't go to Field of Dreams. Like I go to this movie. This is my baseball movie.
Oh yeah. Yeah. This is, This is, I mean, this is so baseball.
Like, yeah,
I'll dabble in a little Field of Dreams. I mean, I'm not going to lie, I'm a big fan, but yeah, they both carry huge, huge, like, nostalgic weight in my, mm-hmm. in my pantheon of baseball movies from my childhood, you know,
I mean,
they're both exceptional for totally different reasons, but
Yeah, both of them are commentary on Americans' love affair with baseball in very different emotional ways. Like, and there's, and the thing is with these underdogs of the Indians, their motivation is basically to say screw you to the boss and then win enough games so you can see your tits. Like, that's it. Like, like, that's like, I find that hilarious that's their motivator. Like,
yeah.
To get revenge, but also this other game of like, well, we're going to keep revealing pieces of her, you know, because she used to be a showgirl. Like, that's why they had access to her as in, like, I forgot her background for so long when I watched the movie as a kid and stuff. I'm like, where did they get a picture of her naked? Like, where did that come from? Because she was a showgirl. So, of course.
Yeah. And then, of course, that's not Margaret Whitten's body either. But
no, of course. Like, yeah. But like, it's such a dude funny thing. I don't know, like, I it's all hilarious, like, it, all these pieces work. The side motivation is so silly.
Should we do a little box office glory, see how it did?
Sure.
Major League, and believe it or not, guys, which was shot in Milwaukee, not Cleveland. Shot the opening in Cleveland, the rest in Milwaukee. That was only because of the stadium schedule. They couldn't work it out. But anyway, had an $11 million budget. It opened April 7th, 1989 at number one.
Hey. Yeah.
Nice. Opened up against,
it's not oftentimes we get number ones.
Not often.
I know. it opened up against the Dream Team, Jean-Claude Van Damme, Cyborg, and Dead Love Calm. Love
that movie. Dude, I watched Cyborg all the time as a kid. All the time.
Major League dethroned Rain Man, which was in week 17.
Wow.
Yeah, so it took down good old Tom Cruise. It had an $8.8 million opening week, a $49.7 million domestic run, another $25.3 internationally for a $75 million run. It was the number 27 movie of 1989, right between Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, and See No Evil, Hear No Evil. The top three at the box office in 1989, of course, were Batman, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and Lethal Weapon 2. It went on to find much more success as well on video and on cable. This was a big renter. It led to two sequels. I kind of want to cover Major League 2 down the road, but it's just not a wildly different movie.
Yeah, yeah.
It's almost
the same. Is that the ones like, you have no marbles? Is that part three?
That's two. That's two.
Okay.
Wesley Snipes becomes such a big star. He did not come back for two, but they did bring back Willie Mays Hayes, played by Omar Epps.
Hey.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's another fun movie. You like these characters. Why not watch it? Major League 3, Back to the Minors. Possibly the only one returning was Roger Dorn. And Scott Bakula takes up the mantle as the lead in that one. Not the same vibe, different energy. Mm-hmm. I think that was theatrical. It might have been straight to video, though.
No, I saw it in theaters.
Okay, yeah, there you go.
All right.
Scott Bakula in a baseball movie? Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, you're a big Bakula boy.
I'm a Bakula head.
Bakula's rad.
Absolutely.
All right, so I think it's time, right before we wrap it up, come back to our 6 degrees of reconcinimation. Anybody got an answer?
Yeah, but it's a cop-out, man, because I've used it before.
Oh, all right,
do it.
Go for it.
Rene Russo and Robert Redford are in Avengers Endgame.
Oh,
that's right.
Good one. You outmaneuvered me. Here's the path I had laid out. David, you got something?
David Board wrote The Sting with Robert Redford, who's in that movie.
Nailed it.
That's, yep.
There you go.
Another route. Place. If you want to go a separate route, Paul Newman in Butch Cassidy is in The Color of Money with Tom Cruise, who's in The Outsiders and Young Guns with Emilio Estevez, brother of Charlie Sheen, co-star of Men at Work.
Was Sheen in...
Sheen's in Young Guns, dude.
Sheen's in both of those movies, isn't he?
Yeah, that's true. Yep.
Sheen's so, definitely... Is he in Outsiders?
No, Emilio's only in Outsiders, but Sheen and Cruise are both... Cruise has a cameo in Young Guns.
Gotcha.
So,
Very cool.
Well, cool. Well, I'm really glad we covered this one, guys. And
I'm gonna do
the fastest wrap up. I'm really glad we covered this one. I'm excited it's baseball season. And so check us out on social media. We're Reconcinimation Podcast on all platforms. Check out our archives at reconcinimation.com. And thank you to our friends, E.K. Wimmer for the theme music, Curtis Moore for the poster. And we will see you next time on Reconcinimation.
Play ball and take care.
Also, right. Play ball. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Was it? Oh, I stole your shit. Sorry,
I love
dude.
It. But play ball, baby.
Something I think you all ought to know about. It seems that Mrs. Phelps doesn't think too highly of our worth. She put this team together because she thought we'd be bad enough to finish dead last, knocking attendance down to the point where she could move the team to Miami and get rid of all of us for better personnel.
Even me?
Even you, Dorn.
What if we don't finish last?
She'll replace you with somebody who will. After this season, you'll be sent back to the minors or given your outright release.
Well, then I guess there's only one thing left to do.
What's that?
Win the whole fucking thing.